Despite all the attention around the upcoming second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, we in the United States still know very little about North Korea, its people, and their aspirations. There is, of course, no public opinion polling, and single-party rule means there's no platform where the Korean Workers' Party carries out an in-depth discussion on the direction of the country. There is, however, one place where the ruling party outlines its desires for the country: literature. As a result, literature is the window through which the outside world can begin to understand what North Korea's leaders envision as an ideal society. Of particular interest, what of North Korea's promise to deliver a strong and prosperous country by 2012? How are they messaging the party's accomplishments? Has it arrived? If it has, how does North Korea explain the economic challenges that the people still face? If it has not yet arrived, why should the people continue to have confidence in the party? Our guest today, a researcher of North Korean literature, will address these questions and more. From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yang Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. Dr. Meredith Shaw is an associate professor of comparative politics at Tokyo University. Her research on comparative politics of East Asia have been published in the Journal of Conflict Research, and she's frequently a contributor to The Conversation and The National Interest. She recently received her PhD from the University of Southern California, and in addition to her many accomplishments in academia, she has also worked at the Korean Institute of National Unification and taught computer literacy in Japan. Her blog, dprklit.blogspot.com, is a source for everything you need to know about North Korean literature today. We're incredibly honored to have her on Korean Context today. Dr. Shaw, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, and thanks for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
The topic of your recent contribution to KAI on North Korean literature and its uses by the state, perhaps to deliver some ideological message. It's not every day, though, that people really talk about North Korean literature. It's not accessible at Barnes & Noble's, and it's not really taught in global literature. Would you be able to give the listeners a sense for what exactly is typical of North Korean literature? Is there such thing as like romantic novels in North Korea? Is there fantasy? Is there Game of Thrones-esque novels in North Korea? What does North Korean literature look like?
I wish there was a North Korean Game of Thrones. I think that would be truly wonderful. North Korean fiction and the arts in general in North Korea are designed to serve the party. So the party within its organization has a separate division for Korean writers. Everyone who publishes a fiction story in North Korea is a member of the Korean Writers Union. This union has, I guess you would call them seminars, month-long seminar every year where it gathers their writers together and works on what they're going to do and what they're going to produce. So you can say that the fiction-producing apparatus of North Korea is a state-run organ, just the way you would expect a country to have its own economic policy and its military policy. But North Korea also has an artistic policy and a cultural policy, and that's where these writers come in. So among the things that I've read, there are novels that have romantic elements to them. There are novels that have some love stories that are pretty clear. But the main purpose of the novel and the overarching story has to match the ideological message that the party wants to get across, which sometimes limits the romance. There are some science fiction stories in children's literature, and Daphne Zur is a scholar of North Korean literature who's done some work on that. Most of what I read is the leader representation literature, so stories that are specifically following Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. Those stories are obviously pretty much set in North Korea and talk about the leaders going around North Korea and helping the country. So there's very little room for action or romance or space aliens or anything like that, or dragons, sadly.
And just to give a better sense for how North Koreans are consuming this literature, are these sold in bookstores? How is the main mechanism through which North Koreans consume, I guess, would you call these hagiographies, like, how, or propaganda? How would you describe these books, and How do North Koreans come in contact with them?
So from what I understand, the short stories are printed in the party literary journal Joseon Munak or Cheongnyeon Munak. And these are, I believe they may be sold in bookstores, but they're also distributed within the party. And possibly people might encounter them at study sessions, after work study sessions. Some stories are read in school, I believe. I did a survey of some North Korean defectors in Seoul. I was only able to find about 20 people to ask. But among those people, about half had never read fiction in North Korea. The half that had read them mostly read them in journal form, but there were some who went to libraries and actually checked out the books and read them in the library. And some had found books in bookstores, and one person had read books on an e-reader, which I thought was very interesting. When you look at more recently, the regime has created a number of really helpful websites that are actually providing these stories online, which is very helpful for my research because I no longer have to find a special archive that carries them. And on the online websites, they'll have the story in HTML form, and they'll also, a lot of the time, they'll have an audio tape version. So that leads me to think that some people might be listening to them on smartphones that are now being used in the country.
What about the ideological message that you mentioned earlier? What is the state trying to impose on the North Korean consumers through these books and stories? Has that changed over time with the changing technology, as you mentioned, or has that remained a little consistent over the years?
The stories and the overarching themes, when you look at them, at first glance, they all seem very similar. And you have to sort of look to see where the thematic changes are. They adhere to the standards of socialist realism, which was developed in the Soviet Union. And part of socialist realism is that stories have to be positive, have to be very optimistic, have to feature a hero or a heroine overcoming some obstacles and never losing faith. So they're sort of relentlessly forward-looking and optimistic in their nature. But when you look at what the main characters are fighting against over time, their principal concerns, those can change over time. And I think it provides a window into what the party thinks the people should know about its efforts to improve their lives. So, for instance, you see a lot of stories now about the party trying to deal with the environmental problems, the flooding, the drought that sometimes affects the crops, and also the deforestation issue, which has become a very serious issue. So you see more stories now dealing with the natural environment and how difficult that's become.
And these were issues that were present in North Korea in the 90s as well during the Great Famine, but you're suggesting that they're being addressed more recently in literature.
Yeah, and one thing I should mention is that there's at least a 3 or 4 year lag in when an issue gets addressed in literature. So you might wonder, what has North Korea written about Donald Trump Kim summit? They're not going to get to that for at least another couple years. Right now, they're writing stories about things that happened in like 2010, 2012. It seems like to be a writer in North Korea, you have to let a little distance fall in place so that you know how the party interpreted what happened and what the official take is on whether it was a success or not. I attribute that to the writers being very cautious. They don't want to write a story about how great the summit with Trump was, and then 2 years later, something happens that no longer supposed to be so positive about that summit. So you have to wait. But yes, the famine period, at the time, they wouldn't have covered that people were struggling. But later on, there was a very moving novel written about the famine period called Kangge Jeongsin that talked in surprisingly honest detail about people struggling, obviously still optimistic and still people overcoming their difficulties with help from the party. But they did acknowledge that there were difficulties. And you see that today in fiction when they're writing, why are there no trees anymore? And one character will say, oh, well, back in the period of the difficulties, some greedy people chopped down the trees to sell them for money. They have a narrative. It's not necessarily a full narrative, but they are saying they are trying to come up with some explanation for what's become too obvious to ignore.
It also sounds like the North Korean writers are serving a little bit like historians, much like how historians are supposed to leave some space between contemporary events and what they write about. It seems like North Korean writers are also waiting for, as you said, party guidance on kind of how they should frame the issue. On that point, does that suggest that anything that does arise in North Korean literature, so when you talk about issues like overcoming climate change, does that suggest that the state itself is also, through allowing these pieces to be written, demonstrating its confidence in being able to address these issues now?
It would be very difficult for me to speculate about that because I have no way of knowing what the state really thinks about the reality of the situation. You can sometimes extrapolate, for instance, civilians and military relations. If the story says something about, oh, the army guys are getting along so great with the locals keep trying to give them presents. This actually happened in one story. The local people keep trying to give the military presence and the military isn't allowed to accept them because that would be illegal, and so everyone's upset because they can't give the military presence. And, you know, it's kind of this over-the-top depiction of how great the military and the civilian population are getting along. I can extrapolate from that that maybe there are some problems between, you know, civil-military relations, and the stories are trying to put a really over-the-top positive spin on it. But I can only say I think that this seems to be a concern. I can't really speculate as to when it became a concern or what they think is going to happen.
You mentioned that the specific genre, I guess, the themes that you focus on in North Korean literature is leadership depiction. And we've now had three leaders in North Korea, each quite different in their persona, from a very confident and outgoing Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il, who was more inward and shy and not very comfortable in public, to Kim Jong-un, who's kind of replicating his grandfather. Have you also noticed any changes in the ideological message that is carried in the depiction of the leaders?
As far as confidence goes, I would say the leaders are all depicted as basically the same person, which is very inconsistent with what you actually see on TV. Even in North Korea, they would have to have observed that Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-un are much more affable than Kim Jong-il. But in the stories, they're all described in the same way. Ruddy cheeks, glowing smile, booming voice, loving everyone that they encounter, and just being super friendly and super confident and aware of what's going on around them, and not having any insecurities about the people they're interacting with. And there is a sort of cookie-cutter list of traits that the Korean Writers Union gives to the writers who are allowed to write about the leaders, that they're always supposed to be described in this way. The distinction that I noticed between Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un seems to be mostly related to Kim Jong-un being very young. There's some reports that when he first took over, some people inside the country thought he was too young and were skeptical that he wouldn't be able to rise to the occasion. We don't know if that's true or not, but certainly the stories that you see coming out around that time start talking about youth in a very different way, linking it to innovation and growth and creativity. This is not just Kim Jong-un being creative, but also some of the other protagonists in the stories are increasingly younger people. Or maybe there's a senior scientist who's been at his job for a long time and he can't solve this problem, he can't figure it out. And then this younger technician comes in and sees what he's doing wrong and shows him the way. So you see a shift in the way youth is perceived as something that's helpful and that's key to moving the country forward. I mean, North Korea always had this kind of Soviet attitude of, you know, the youth vanguard of the country. But in the stories that I've read from the Kim Jong-il era, I didn't see young people taking on that much of a leading role in the stories.
Who were kind of taking the lead in the Kim Jong-il era? Was it more the military, as you mentioned, since it was during the heyday of North Korea trying to produce nuclear weapons and focusing on the importance of the military? Who were the main protagonists that you noticed?
In the stories that I've read, which are by no means exhaustive, I have encountered a lot of stories in the Kim Jong-il era highlight artists and filmmakers and choreographers. His big thing was the arts. His policy was military first, but you know, the fiction in North Korea really doesn't talk about the military as much as you would expect. And when they do talk about it, it's always said in the Korean War era or in the anti-Japanese era. They don't really talk about military engagements in the modern era. They will talk about the military being deployed to help out with the farming or with flood relief, but you don't see stories about military engaged in fights on the border or anything like that.
That's quite interesting, yeah. Given how cultural products from North Korea that Americans are most familiar with would be propaganda posters. And in those, they're quite militaristic, often emphasizing the force of arms that North Korea has, nuclear weapons. And so it's quite interesting that in the literary products that are produced for the North Korean people that the military isn't so heavily emphasized. You mentioned that the North Korean literary pieces provide a certain kind of goal for the North Korean people. So in the new era under Kim Jong-un, the literary pieces that you've observed and read, where are they guiding the Korean people? What is the aspirational goal of society that you've observed in these cultural products?
Stories in general seem to be kind of cheerleading the role of the party and encouraging people to trust in the party. There's an interesting refrain that I've seen more and more recently of people having an expectation that the party is going to help them and then getting in trouble, but then Kim Jong-un says, well, at least they have faith in the party, and so that is in itself a reward. Like, there's this story about the flooding in the northeast a few years ago destroyed a lot of homes, and there's a story about Kim Jong-un sending the military in to rebuild. And in the story, the military does such a great job of building all these wonderful new homes for the people. He says it looks like a socialist fairyland. And then they hear that there was one guy who his home was undamaged by the flood, but he wanted this nice new home for himself like everyone else was getting. So he destroyed his own home, and then he tried to get the military to build him a new home. So all of the other officials are just appalled by this. And they say, how can, you know, he destroyed his own home. That's terrible. And Kim Jong-un says, no, it's actually good because it means that he has faith in the party. So I think that this man, even though he was wrong to destroy property, he should be rewarded with a new home anyway because he showed true faith in the party.
Wow.
I don't think that's something that would have been written in the Kim Jong-il era.
On the topic of new themes in the new era, you wrote significantly about the strong and prosperous, the phrase strong and prosperous. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about the phrase and how it's used in literature by the state?
Sure. So this phrase, strong and prosperous nation or strong and prosperous era, started building in importance in the years before Kim Jong-un took power. It was really sort of coincidental because 2012 would have been the 100th birthday of the original founding leader, Kim Il-sung. And so the regime kind of picked that date in like 2005, 2006 and said, oh, by the time we get to 2012, which is going to be year 100 for us because they start counting their years from the day their leader was born. At 2012, we're going to be a strong and prosperous country. We're going to have power. We're going to have electricity working all the time. We're going to have a military deterrent that nobody's ever going to bother us. And at that point, we'll finally be able to live a good life. It's like the old Animal Farm scene where they just think that if they can get that windmill built, then everything will be great. And so North Korea kind of said to the people, just hang in there because in 2012, we're going to be a strong and prosperous country. Well, 2012 came, and they got a new leader, which they obviously hadn't seen coming. So the new leader brought a lot of changes, which weren't necessarily the changes that they had predicted. The country's still not what you would call strong and prosperous. And yet they continued to use this phrase, the strong and prosperous era, and they said, we have seen the dawn of the strong and prosperous era, and it is Kim Jong-un. So when you look at how this is used in fiction, it seems almost to validate that this new leader, all the changes he's making were according to plan. Like they're all part of the strong and prosperous era. So if Kim Jong-un wants to have high rises and Ferris wheels and dolphin shows, then that's a sign of the strong and prosperous era. So it's been repurposed in, I think, a really interesting way.
Literature is kind of playing the role of perhaps backfilling for some of the material deficits that perhaps still exist. Would that be an accurate description, that they are building up the achievements of Kim Jong-un as evidence of a strong
Right. Well, obviously they had to do something. They had this expectation that things would really change. And at the same time, they had an interesting problem that you have a new absolute ruler. Even if he's a chip off the old block, he's got his own priorities, his own interests. As we all know, he really likes basketball. He likes sports. His father, not so much. And when you're the absolute ruler, you tend to do things the way you want, even if it's different from the way things were. So this presents a problem for a country like North Korea, because they can't say that Kim Jong-il's stuff was bad. They have to preserve the previous leader was great and the current leader is also great in whatever he does. But there are changes. And so how do you explain the changes? Well, now that we're strong and prosperous, we have these new amusement parks and things that we couldn't have before because we weren't strong and prosperous yet.
In a way, it was also politically convenient that there was an expectation for some kind of change to occur. And that just coincided with a new leadership
change. Yeah, it was really coincidental. And frankly, I thought, and a lot of people thought at the time, that this was the perfect storm, that they have this year that's supposed to be a year of victory. And not only did they not have the victory, but they have a new leader who's completely untested. He's way too young. Nobody knows who he is. He's surrounded by people that maybe don't like him so much. And it seemed like those two things would conspire to cause a lot of problems. And yet the combination of the two was weirdly helpful.
So you mentioned earlier about the youth being a bigger, more prominent theme in literature in the Kim Jong-un era. Are there any other motifs that come to mind?
Yeah, a lot of the news stories now, they'll talk about the new buildings, new construction, particularly in the capital. These buildings are brand new high-rises for people, housing complexes, athletic complexes, and the buildings themselves are quite different from buildings that North Korea has built in the past that followed the Soviet model. They built this new science center that's shaped like an atom with this weird wings coming out of it. From the air, I've seen photos of it that the regime has released that it looks amazing. It looks absolutely fantastic. And the same thing of the buildings on the Future Scientist Street that are from a distance, they're kind of curved glass buildings that are in bright colors, and they look really nice lit up at night. But then when you zoom in on them, as some foreign observers have done, you see that there's no glass in the windows and doesn't seem like there's anybody living there. It doesn't seem like it has running water or any facilities, but it looks nice. So in the stories, they talk about how people are given these apartments by the leadership because they work in some industry that the leader considers to be particularly important, and they're so happy to get this beautiful new home. And the stories almost seem obligated to mention at least one of these structures at some point in the story. So even if it's a story about something completely different, they'll find a way to mention, oh, you know, then Kim Jong-un drove past the new Cheongjun apartment complex. Or, you know, it just seems to pop up regularly in the stories.
Demonstrating, I guess, in a way, the as you mentioned earlier, the party's accomplishments to date.
We could think of it as implanted advertising almost.
Oh, right, right.
Because they don't have advertising in a communist country, but it's sort of like our equivalent of Leave It to Beaver holding up, like, Tide laundry detergent or, you know, like something. So he'll be just doing something completely unrelated, and then he'll say, I'm too busy this afternoon, I'm going to see the dolphin show at the aquarium. And then that's it, but he just mentions it.
To close, one question that I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds, listening to this fascinating research that you've done, is it effective? Have all this writing on the party's accomplishments, on the benefits of having a young, youthful leader, has this all translated into any gains for the party, in your view?
Yeah, so that's a really hard question to answer definitively. I believe that the amount of resources that the regime continues to put into its fiction writing suggests that it serves a useful purpose, at least within the rank and file of the party. I don't think that regular people outside of the kind of privileged ranks of the party are much affected by these fictional stories, and certainly people who live out in the rural areas don't have access to this kind of information anyway. But it does seem like even if the people don't believe word for word what they're reading is true, maybe it imbues a sense of optimism for the future that, oh, the party's writing about the problem of deforestation, so that implies that they're going to do something about it. And as a way of showing the country that the way of life is improving. The other kind of story that I haven't really discussed is there are stories that depict a model citizen, not Kim Jong-un, but they'll follow someone who happens to work in a particular industry who's doing a really good job, and the people around that person are maybe not as faithful or not as loyal. So the other purpose of fiction, in addition to reassuring people, is saying, this is what we want you to be like. This is the ideal citizen. This young mother who works hard and finds a new way to make her quota or something like that. So it's also a kind of a blueprint for being a good socialist citizen.
That is it for our episode today. Many thanks to Dr. Meredith Shaw for coming on the show today, and to you listeners for tuning in. You can find the recording of Dr. Shaw's presentation at KAI in the link presented in the description. And you can also find her blog at dprklit.blogspot.com. One footnote. Dr. Shaw mentioned that Daphne Zur is the foremost expert in North Korean science fiction. Korean Context interviewed Dr. Zur for our episode on December 14, 2018. Please take a listen if you want to learn more about the role science fiction played in early North Korean statecraft. If you have any questions or comments, send us a tweet at KOREAECONINST. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcast. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page and YouTube channel, where you can stream our events live. Our next event is with Dr. Moon Jung-in, Special Advisor to President Moon Jae-in for Foreign Affairs and National Security, on February 26th from noon to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. See you there!